My name is Barbara Anderson, and my husband is unmanageable. And he's not in here, so I can say that. I am very grateful to be with y'all today, and I actually did give him the opening, but he's in the room doing the voice book right now, so we don't have it. So I'm going to start our meeting by reading you my 12 steps before Al-Anon. One, I discovered that I was powerful over others and that your lives were certainly unmanageable. Two, came to believe that I was the power greater than you that could restore you to sanity. Three, made a decision for you to turn your will and life over to the care of me. Four, made a searching and fear-filled inventory of everyone that I knew and found them lacking. Five, admitted to God, myself, and anyone that would listen the exact nature of your wrongs. Six, became entirely willing to aid you in removing all your defects of character. Seven, humbly assisted you in removing your defects of character, except when to do so would cause me harm. Eight, made a list of all persons that had harmed me and vowed to get even with them all. Nine, waited for everyone to make direct amends to me. 10, continued to take your inventory and when you were wrong, promptly pointed it out. 11, sought through martyrdom, mothering, managing, and manipulating to improve your conscious contact with me, asking only that you read my mind and carry out my wishes. And 12, having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of this type of living, I tried to drag all those I loved down with me and get sympathy and pity from all that would listen. And what is pretty sad is that that was pretty much my life before Al-Anon. Today's meeting, we're going to be looking at acceptance. And the journey to find acceptance in my life was certainly a journey away from those steps and a journey through the first three steps that helped me find a power greater than me in my life and begin to transform my life. This morning, we're going to start by hearing from Linda B. Linda's from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm very excited to have her here with us. And she's going to share, and then I'm going to share.
Okay, thank you. Hi, I'm Linda Bazans, and I am a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Group. You know, I've never heard those three M's before. What was that? Martyrdom, manipulation, and mothering. I'm glad we don't have those as part of our program, but I certainly had them as part of my life, so I never heard that before. That was very interesting. Okay, acceptance. First of all, what an honor this is to do this. I haven't met Barbara before, but I've known about Barbara, and she's met, I think, Peter. And it's just really an opportunity to do this, even though I have no idea what this is going to look like. Well, God does, and we'll find out at the end and see what you think of it. But it is a privilege to be asked to do this, and acceptance is probably the one thing that is the most important for us to search and seek and look for in our lives and to endorse and enforce. Because if you're of the same ilk that I am, you know, I'm one of those kicking and screaming kind of people, and why me? And one thing my sponsor taught me, my second sponsor, you know, it's funny. You don't know anything about me, and yet I'm talking about acceptance. Most of the time when I'm talking, I tell my story, and so it sort of fits in. But I've been in Al-Anon for 42 years. I came when I was 21 years old. So you can do the math quite quickly on that one. And I've had three wonderful sponsors. And each one of them has imparted so much wisdom and so much love to me that I'm just a collage of those women, But I'm a collage of so many other people. I stand on the shoulders of so many. So I don't even know what's mine anymore. All I know is what comes in and it goes through my body and it comes out in hopefully my actions and my words. At least that's my wish. But one of my second sponsor, she said to me, I was always a person who was, why me? Why is this happening to me? Just pitiful. Why? Why is he behaving this way? Why are the children this way? And Marcy said to me, you know, you are a real blamer. And she said, one of the things that you're going to change is you are no longer allowed to say to me, why? She said, why makes you a victim? And what can I do about it gives you power. So from now on, we're going to talk in terms of what can I do about it. And you are not allowed to use the word why. Well, it was quite hard to change that for a while because it was such a pattern. And I knew she was right, but it was, you know, so much part of who I was. And so now today, one of the things that I think certainly aids me in acceptance is not asking why, but what can I do about it? And what can I do about it brings in the power of this incredible program. And why makes me just this little whiner that was so, so stuck. And when you ask that question, you're always blaming. So when I went to bed last night, I was thinking about the topic at hand, of course, because I always want to look good.
You weren't thinking about me?
And no, not that time. I think about you a lot, though. You probably can imagine who that is. That voice. That's my wonderful husband, Bob. So I was thinking about what does acceptance really mean to me, and how does it manifest? And one of the things that is part of my program, when I get up in the morning, hopefully before my feet hit the ground, I try to do the first three steps. And the first step is I look at the powerlessness in my life. I look at the things that I need to do today. I look at the fact that I cannot control the outcome in a significant way. I can do my job, but I cannot control the outcome. And I look at some of the things that either I predict might be unmanageable or because of my nature, I know that I could take to that level. And I just try to look at step one and my day. And then I look at step two. And I know that the insanity that I can bring can be removed if I just concentrate on the fact that I'm not in charge. And I know that I can be restored to or brought into a sane and a wholesome and a well day, a day filled not too much of me, with too much of me, because when the days are filled too much of what I want, I get in trouble. And then I turn my will and my life and my day over to the God of my understanding. And then I say the third step prayer. And I ask my higher power to relieve me of the bondage of all the selves, the self-will and the selfishness and the self-centeredness and the self-righteousness. And I turn my will and my life over to that God. And then I get up and I get going. Now on a good day, I stay in that posture for quite a while. But then I'll catch myself on a bad day when I have my plan. You know, we all have a plan for the day, and it's necessary to have a plan for the day. But my plan gets interrupted by maybe an Al-Anon phone call and somebody who needs to talk, and I'm thinking, Jiminy, you know, I've got a lot of things to do, and I really wanted to take my shower, and I wanted to be ready, and I really wanted to be on the road by 9:30 or 10, and these are all self-imposed things, because I have the blessing of not working. And so I really have a day that's my own. And I can get into that, I call it a snit, really, really fast on some days. But then on the best days, all of a sudden, I'll say, didn't you just turn your will and your life over to the care of God about 30 minutes ago? Didn't you just say, let me be of service to you? And then I can pull myself back and I can get into hopefully what I call acceptance. And the acceptance is, I am meant to be of service. I am meant to be the best example of the big book that anyone can read today. I am meant to love you and be caring and nurturing to you. And then I'm okay again. Until the next thing comes up that I don't really want to do. But see, by saying those first three steps, I can go back to that basis. And God willing, get out of me. And when I get out of me, as most of you know that are in this room, you have the same tools I do. When we get out of ourselves, we show up the best in our day. So, if I'm not about my will, but about God's will, I'm in acceptance. And then one of the other little tricks that I use is I try to choose happiness. And by choosing happiness, what I'm choosing is I'm choosing my higher power. I'm choosing God. But when I'm choosing God, I am a better person than I can ever be. And if I have that focus, when something happens, I can say, yes, I can do that. Or I'd be glad to do that. That's even nicer. Or of course. And I used to be a person who, you know, it was funny. I used to do the things, but I begrudged it. I did it, and the reason I did it was because I wanted to look good. That's such a thread through my whole life. It's really one of my biggest defects, and in some ways it's one of my assets too. But it's a defect. And so the reason I would do things was so that you'd like me. You'd think better of me. It wasn't so I could be of service to you. So maybe the outcome looks similar, but boy, there's a big change in here between doing, the reasons are so different. About 15 or 20 years ago, one of my sponsors, Marcy, the same one I mentioned before, we were talking about our programs, and I was, I guess, complaining to her, or maybe noticing, I don't know. I said, I can feel myself getting complacent. And what I would do is I would have my three or four Al-Anon books lined up on the kitchen table. And I was finding myself reading them every day, but reading them more to get them out of the way than anything else. Because I'm a good German person. And when I make a decision, I stick with that decision. And therefore, I'm going to read those books. But I wasn't getting much out of them. And so I was sharing this with Marcy. And I was saying, you know, I've got to change something because I know me well enough now to know what I'm doing. And she said, well, one of the things that she does is she does a New Year's resolution every year around her program. And I said, oh, tell me about that. She said, well, every January 1st. And she said, I really start thinking about it maybe a couple weeks before, beginning of December, around that time, of what I can do next year to revitalize my program. And so she said, I would recommend that to you. I take a look at that. That might be something that could be beneficial to you. And so we talked about it quite a bit. And she said, I'll make a deal with you. She said, how about this? This is something I've done many times, is every month I take a step. So January 1st to January 31st, we'll be on step one. Do you want to do it with me? And I said, absolutely. Great idea. thought it was a really great idea till I got to April. And I realized that this meant I had to do another inventory, and in May would mean, if I'm going to do what I've made the deal, is I'm going to do another fifth step. And I have to admit I reneged. I did 1, 2, and 3, and I sort of did 4, but I did not do another inventory. Now, of course, I've failed, and so I quit. So the rest of the year passed, and I made a deal with her the next year that I would do that, and I did. And since then, every December, I start thinking about what I can do to add to my program that would revitalize it and keep it new and keep it fresh. And probably about 10 or 15 years ago, I was at the point where I didn't have a New Year's resolution, and I wanted one, and it was January 1st, and I have to have one on January 1st, and I don't. And I'm talking to Marcy, and she said, well, don't worry about it, Precious. She said, you'll think of something. Well, that wasn't good enough. See, I wanted it now. January 1st is the day you're supposed to have this, and okay. So I'm meeting with a woman probably around the 5th or the 6th of the month, and we were talking about she had just lost a friend. A very quick, I believe it was an aneurysm, but the person was here 1 minute and gone the next, somewhat like you described last night, and how devastating that was. And we had had that happen not too long before that to a friend of ours. A couple was walking down a road on a May day, and a student was coming back to college or high school to pick up something and hit Kathy, and she fell into her husband's arms and died. 1 minute here, 1 minute gone. And I said to Amelia, the woman I was speaking with, I said, you know, if we really believed that we didn't have tomorrow, we would live today so differently. And as I was speaking, I heard my resolution. And I was just dynamite until about March. I was like golden. I lived every day, I believe, to the fullest. I became less irritable. Because every moment, see, this moment, the same group will never be in this room again. This is just a special moment. So pay attention to who's here. Pay attention to what we have. And I was, I would be in line at Target and I wouldn't be counting the number of articles in your basket. I would just be happy that I was in line with you. And I mean, I was really a nice person because this moment was mine. And then I forgot. And all of a sudden it was June and I thought, wow, what happened? Then I went back and I renewed it and I renewed it. That is the heart. I renew it every year. I try to add something else to it, but I try to renew that every year. That is the hardest thing I can do, is to stay in the moment. But when I'm in the moment, I am in acceptance. And I'm in appreciation. And I believe I'm in union with my God. But it's when I get out of the moment and I get into this, that I get into trouble. So by staying in the moment, I'm okay. Right now, I am really more than okay. I'm really fulfilled. I am really in love. I am really happy. I'm the best me I can be. And when I start thinking about what's going to happen, maybe this afternoon, or when I start thinking of one of our kids, or when I start thinking about finances, or when I start thinking about anything but God in the moment, I lose the acceptance and I get into the selfishness of me. So when I do that, I am the best. We have 3 children and they're all in the program. They're all alcoholics. They're all men. And they're all wonderful men. And they all have their own lives to live. And when I remember that, and I accept who they are at the moment that they're in front of me, we have just, and we do have a wonderful relationship in spite of me because of Al-Anon. I have a great relationship with all three of our kids. But you know, you can always find something to worry about. At least I certainly can. And with the children, for sure, they're the easiest to worry about. Because I don't know if we love them the most, but maybe we feel more responsible for them. I don't know. But so I have to stop worrying about them and know that my God, who takes such good care of me, he can worry about them. He can take care of them. I don't have to take care of them. I don't have to take their experiences away from them. And that's really hard because, see, I want it to be easier for them. So maybe I'll just tweak this a little bit, and then they won't have it so hard there. And that's the hardest thing for me to do, is to not get into the tweaking business with my kids, our kids. I have to protect my peace of mind, and that keeps me in acceptance. And by that I mean there's so many things that sabotage the moment. There's so many things that can sabotage. Okay, I almost just got into a political, and I'm terrible with politics, but discussion with somebody, I know you're in the room, and I went, no, I'm not doing that right now because that's not what I want to think about. So I always say there are three things that I have control over. One is my relationship with my God, my Father. The second one is the attitude I bring to the day. And the third thing are the things that I put in and take into my body. And that includes, of course, food, clean air. But it really, very important, it includes the things that I choose to continue to think about. Or it includes the things that I shouldn't think about, like gossip. I don't want to watch violent things on TV. I like mysteries, but I like the murder to have taken place and then to sort of work through how it all happened. But I don't want all the gore. I have to protect that, because if I don't, I sort of spin off. And I've learned that through Al-Anon. I've learned the things that are good for me and the things that are bad for me. And I have a choice. And I have a choice every single day. And what I choose is the most important. And if I start the day by choosing God, I'm the best me that I can be. And that is my job. And Kathy, or Barbara, I'm going to pass it on to you. Kathy, I don't know. Sorry. Okay, thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Barbara Anderson. I'm a very grateful Al-Anon.
Hi, Barbara.
It's good to be with y'all. And this is a great crowd for a Friday. Thank everybody for being here. The first thing that I had to come to accept when I came into the program was that my life had been affected by alcoholism. I came to Al-Anon because I was dating a guy who was in AA, who told me he wouldn't marry anybody unless they were in Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon to manipulate him into marrying me. You know, I'll admit that to you. That's why I went. So, and it worked. We've been married 25 years now. But what I found was I really had to look at myself. Al-Anon's book, From Survival to Recovery, says that adult children of alcoholics have an abnormal sense of reality. We think that our life is like everybody else's, and I really didn't accept that I had grown up in active alcoholism. I didn't see it. When Dick first asked me if I had any alcoholism in my family, and probably for several months after I started going to the program, I told him no. I didn't see it. It wasn't on my radar screen. I didn't recognize that that's what had really affected my life. But of my grandparents, three out of four of them were alcoholic. My mother's sister and brother were both alcoholic, and she probably was, too. She quit drinking at some point. My dad was a baby of 14, and out of his brothers and sisters, about two-thirds of them were alcoholic. He came from a family that caused the most notorious shootout ever in a North Carolina courthouse over moonshine. So, you know, I mean, that's true. So I came from a lot of alcoholism, and I really didn't see it. My story found me. You know, I remember when I first went to speaker meetings, I would sit and I would say, well, I'll never have a story, because I didn't really recognize what my life had been like. I didn't see that I spent every Saturday morning going to liquor stores with my grandmother, and that probably wasn't normal. You know, I didn't see that she passed out every Saturday night and then would wake back up and take me out to honky tonks with her. I didn't see that was unusual. You know, so it took me a while for me to recognize that I belonged here. In fact, I came to Al-Anon for about a year and a half. And I really thought that I was here to help y'all. Dick and I went to the International Convention in 1985. And we got on the plane. It was an L-10-11. And somebody made an announcement, is there anybody on the plane that's a friend of Bill W., and there were over 100 people on the plane that were going to the International. So he was so excited, he was bouncing around saying hello to everybody, and I don't think I've ever felt more out of place. You know, I just didn't feel like I fit in. We got to Montreal, and we were walking around, and people were hugging each other, and I felt more and more alone because I was on the outside looking in, and that's how I lived most of my life. You know, I always felt like a wallflower, and I didn't land in this program and automatically feel like I was at home. I still was outside the circle. And that particular night, you know, Dick grew up in AA in Louisville, Kentucky, and the family recovery was very active there. AA and Al-Anon were just one. Everywhere he went, there was AA and Al-Anon, and he heard story after story after story of Al-Anon's. He knew everything Al-Anon's tried, and I had tried it all, and nothing worked. You know, nothing worked to manipulate him into doing what I wanted him to do. And so I found myself in Montreal, and it was probably the last thing I could think of to start to try. That night I went into the bathroom, and I came back out and had a razor in my hand. And I said, I think I'm just going to kill myself. And I didn't get the reaction I thought I would get. He started laughing at me. Now, before you think he's too cruel, it was one of those Bic Daisy razors. And, you know, I had been using it about a week to shave my legs, so I wasn't really going to hurt myself with it. But I was that hopeless. I really was that hopeless. And, you know, if there's ever been, you know, if I'm the only one that's ever been physical with the other one, I hit him. And then I just broke. He said, honey, if there's ever a time for you to go to Al-Anon for you, it might be now before you end up really killing yourself. And I just broke. And he said, you know, there's 24-hour meetings here. You know, why don't you start going to Al-Anon for yourself? So the next morning, I went to Al-Anon's opening session of its first international convention, and Lois Wilson was the speaker. And so when I finally got ready to go to Al-Anon for myself, it was Lois Wilson that brought me the message. And I remember her telling the group that day that there wasn't a spiritual side of this program. It was a spiritual program. It was a transforming way of life. We didn't ever have to be the same again. And I heard her words. She also talked about the fact that we had three big A's. Al-Anon, Alateen, and AA, and that we were our family.
And while I was in Montreal, I finally took the first step. I finally moved into the acceptance that I had grown up in active alcoholism and that I was going to die without this program. You know, I don't know if every Al-Anon feels like Al-Anon saved their life, but I certainly do. You know, I really do not believe that I would be here today. I know that eventually I would have killed myself if it hadn't been for this program. You know, the program, the steps worked me. The steps are amazing. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, when I lived most of my life in fear, and the every morning ritual kind of that went in my head was, well, you got to get up. Well, I know I don't want to get up. Well, what would happen if you don't get up? Well, if you don't get up, you probably would lose your job. Well, what would happen if you don't lose your, if you lose your job? Well, I probably would eventually not be able to pay my bills. Well, what would happen if you can't pay your bills? Well, eventually I'd be out on the street as a bag lady. So I would get up in the morning because I didn't want to be a bag lady. You know, I didn't get up in the morning because I looked forward to my day. You know, and so I lived the majority of my life motivated by fear. In 2005, Dick and I had a very difficult year. And I really think that I had begun to live life this way beforehand, but it was one of those landslide years that made a tremendous difference in my life. I had tried to start living life with an attitude of gratitude. I had tried to start living my life looking forward to it, living life looking at a glass half full instead of a glass half empty. But honestly, I'd probably spent the majority of my life looking at what I didn't have. What you had, I wanted. What I had to worry about tomorrow. What I'd missed out on yesterday. I live life in yesterday and tomorrow, and I had missed my own life. I spent the majority of the time looking at, you know, resentment and fear. And it kept me from living my own life. Well, shortly before the beginning of 2005, Dick and I lost our Norwegian Elkhound Booger Bear. He was 18 when he died. And we didn't think we would ever go through something that bad. We cried as we had to put him to sleep, and Dick buried him. And he had met Booger Bear. His name was Booger Bear. He probably went to more conferences than most of you have been to. And, you know, he went with us everywhere. And it was very hard to let go of him. He also taught me a lot about unconditional love. And if you ever look at the word dog in the mirror, it's God. And he had just taught me so much about unconditional love. He was there praying with me often when I was on my knees. He'd get right by me and pray too. And we let go of him. And I thought, and he taught me how to grieve. His death taught me how to grieve. And just shortly after that, January 22nd of 2005, my father died. And my father had Alzheimer's. He was not real well mentally, but physically he was fine. We had managed to move my parents into assisted living and thought they would be there for years. Their bodies were well, at least they appeared to be. We had a beautiful funeral for him, and we went off to Hilton Head, to the Hilton Head Roundup, and we stayed over a day, and we were sitting having some shrimp out on a dock somewhere, and we got a call that my mother had been found non-responsive, and they weren't sure, they had been able to revive her, they weren't sure if she was going to make it. So Dick and I got in the car, and we started driving back, and I was in shock, and Dick was angry, and he was driving a little bit too fast. He got pulled over by the police. And in retrospect, I think that he got pulled over by the police because God wanted him to have something to be angry at other than him, because he kind of fussed about the police and how not nice he was the rest of the way home. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, it was just a few days after my dad had died, and Dick told me not too long ago that he was praying that God would give us some kind of sign that he was in the middle of it all. And I had to stop and go to the bathroom. We stopped at a Wendy's, and we went into the Wendy's, and on the Muzak in the Wendy's, it was playing How Great Thou Art. Now, I've never heard Christian music in a Wendy's. We had just sung that hymn at my father's funeral. And I had to ask somebody if it was actually there, and it was. And it was one of those the feeling just washed over me, okay, God, you're in the middle of this somehow. I have no idea. We got back in time to see my mom, and I was holding one hand, and Dick was holding the other hand, and we were saying the Lord's Prayer, and right in the middle of Thy will be done, my mom passed away, 10 days after my dad. Losing both your parents that quickly was very difficult. But I can tell you that what happened in the middle of all that was, in order for me to get through it, and also just losing my dog, who had really been my child, I wasn't able to have children. I could not live my life focusing on what I had to be sorry for. You know, it wouldn't work. I couldn't move. I had to start looking for God's gift in that day. And you know, it was always there. I think they're always there. You know, when I put on my new pair of glasses, I was glad to see this picture of Chuck young. I've never seen him young before. When I put on my new pair of glasses and I look at life in God's eyes, there's always something there to be grateful for. If I can accept that God's in the middle of today, if God's in the middle of whatever's happening in my life, there's always something there miraculous to see. What happened the day that Booker Bear died, the day that my dad died, the day that my mom died, all 3 days, there was a blue heron out on our lake. Now, that blue heron began to symbolize to me the Spirit of God coming to visit me. I actually looked up blue heron in Native American, the spirituality, and it is a spiritual symbol. So, you know, there was something about that bird showing up that would just, that would, this feeling would wash over me and I'd know everything would be okay. One day I was sitting out on my back dock. It was after dark, and I prayed that God would somehow there let me know that my parents were together. And 30 seconds later, a shooting star went across the sky, a gift of the day. There were so many of them. They were everywhere. You know, it was a phone call. It was a hug. It was a beautiful sunrise. It was a beautiful sunset. It was a letter in the mail. There was always something miraculous there if I'd look for it. And it was a different way of living to anticipate God's gift in the day as opposed to what I had to feel sorry for. Well, Dick and I went to the International in 2005, and he had a physical, and he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And most of y'all know him and know that story, but he couldn't tell me right away. You know, I'd lost my parents. I'd lost my dog, which was basically my child. He couldn't believe that God would take him away in the same year. And he couldn't tell anybody for a while. Actually, he didn't tell me he actually had cancer until 2 days before we left for him to have surgery. He kept on saying he had some precancerous tissue that was going to have to be removed. And somehow or other, I think I knew that we were dealing with more than that, but I didn't really want to know. So we just moved through the motions. And Dick's surgery was just miraculous, and he'll talk to you more about that when he speaks later in the weekend. But I can tell you that in the middle of all that, I mean, we found a new home group, a new family in Rochester, New York. Now, if you're going to go have surgery, and you're going to go, you don't want to lose your husband in Yankee land, you know, so... If you're a native Georgian, so now I'm nothing against y'all. So we had the most miraculous experience up there. We had probably 100 visits to the hospital. People at the hospital were saying, well, "I thought y'all were from Georgia. You know, who is he?" And Dick would kind of say, "I'm just a drunk from the wings." His persistence to survive was unbelievable, and the hope that y'all and the fellowship and the prayers that were with Dick and that are with Tony were unbelievable. It was like this warm feeling of love that would wash over me all the time. I just knew that we were being uplifted in prayer. And I saw that. I saw the love
of the people in the fellowship and not what he was going through. And I did not Google the outcome rates of esophageal cancer survival. I'm really glad that I did not do that. And I probably would have if he told me earlier, you know. So Dick's still here. You know, miraculous things. He is a miracle. And this program is miraculous. On our way home from Rochester, New York, we got a phone call that his mother had been found non-responsive, and we ended up in Louisville, Kentucky, and she died just a few days later. We lost 3 out of 4 parents in 1 year. Dick had had terminal cancer that ended up not being terminal, gratefully, and he lost his ability to work. We didn't have any income coming in from him. And that particular holiday, I remember it was almost like It's a Wonderful Life. Money started coming in from the mail from some of y'all. You know, we didn't ask for it. It just came. And God uplifted us and took care of us, and anticipating God's miracle in the day and accepting one day at a time that God was going to meet my needs. Maybe not my wants, but God was going to meet my needs. I was going to be okay today. Learning how to live life that way has been an amazing journey. Also, recognizing that the program would always be there for me, and I never had to be alone again. You know, I never had to be that person that was sitting on the outside of the circle that was the wallflower. I could be right in the middle of y'all and have a family. You know, there might be one of you here today that's still on the outside of the circle and feels like you don't quite fit in. Let me tell you, I know that pain. This is a wonderful weekend to jump in with both feet and experience the power of living life in the steps for yourself. You never have to be alone again. Linda and I talked about it, and we wanted to open it up to y'all and see if there was anybody that had an acceptance story that would like to share with us. And there's a mic right down here, so if you would like to share, we ask you that you'll come down here and share at the mic so it'll be on the tape. A story. It's about acceptance. Since I just shared the serious stuff, one of the acceptance lessons my sponsor taught me was to accept people's habits. And one of the things that I really struggled with when I first got married was the fact that Dick didn't always put the seat down on the toilet. And so, you know, he was 34 when we got married. And he had lived life singly for a long time. He'd been engaged a bunch of times, but never actually married, got married. And so I just couldn't believe that he didn't respect me enough to put the seat down. And I probably mentioned it to my sponsor too many times. And so, particularly one particular day after I had fallen in the middle of the night, was talking to her about it, and she said, "You cannot mention this to me again unless you will try something." And I said, "What?" She said, "No, I'm not going to tell you what it is until you agree to try it." And now, if your sponsor ever does this to you, it can be kind of scary. So I agreed to try whatever it was. And reluctantly. And so she said, "I want you to put the seat back up for him. You'll always know that it's up, and you won't worry about it." And so I said, "You want me to do what?" And she said, "I want you to put the seat back up for him." And so I said, "You're serious?" And she said, "Yes." And so I tried it. You know, the first couple times I'd slam it back up and probably almost broke the back of the toilet. And but, you know, it started getting funny. You know, I would put it back up, and I'd come out of the bathroom giggling, and Dick would notice I was giggling and probably wonder, but he never said anything. And it got funnier and funnier and funnier because it took him almost a month to notice. And so one day he said, "Have you developed some kind of new unusual bathroom habit?" And I said, "No, honey, I'm just leaving the seat up for you." And, you know, it just wasn't important after that. You know, up or down, I always look. It's
I won't tell you it's always down. I won't tell you it's always up. I learned the purpose. You know, I accepted whichever way the toilet was going to be. It didn't make that much difference. So hope that I don't cause any arguments in here today, but it made a lot of difference to me. And accepting things sometimes is just as simple as meeting somebody where they are and the seat where it is. All right, somebody have an accepted story now.
Hi, my name is Gary, and the acceptance story that I ran across was there's an acceptance pamphlet. It's blue, and it has something along the lines of the words, "Pay no attention to the person that bothers you. If you refuse to at least try this, then some cynical soul will, like me, will come up and say to you that if you didn't think that way, you'd be bored otherwise. To be fed. And if I don't give it something healthy to think about, my mind on its own will go and find something. And chances are it will be an unreconciled resentment. It'll be whoever it is, the boss, the BI, well, I won't do that. That's why it's so important for me to practice the type of acceptance where I know I have to feed this to be healthy. If I don't start off my day healthy, really it is my own fault. But fortunately, we're given instructions of what to do, and I very much need to follow those instructions. Thank you.
I'm Richard Gay. I'm from the Atlanta area. And my acceptance story will be a little fairly short, but... You know, to me, acceptance is really easy for me because it's taken me a long time in my life to learn acceptance. And I find it really becomes easier the older I get because the less time I have to live on this earth here. And as a result of that process, it's drawn me closer to God. What's really helped me is to have an attitude of gratitude. And when I wake up every morning, I thank God for another day to live. And as long as I maintain this attitude of gratitude, life gets so much better. And you start living in the moment and start seeing your glasses half full and not half empty. I'm in a better frame of mind to be of service to other people. It just keeps getting better and better. You know, when things don't go my way or I'm having a tough time financially or in other areas, I thank God for being there and bringing me through those tough times and showing me that, you know, there's some things when I'm having some difficulty in my life, I need to change from what I'm doing. I need to look at, you know, what's my part in this difficult thing that's happening in my life. Invariably, I know I've had the tools to not be in a low spot. All I had to do was to apply them in my life. So even when things are not going my way, I see it as a positive because it's God's way of trying to show me how to be a better person, how to be of service to other people, and to get out of myself. I just thank the Lord for being here and for you two. I'm not Al-Anon, I'm AA, but I've learned a lot. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Peggy Sue. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Peggy Sue.
acceptance for me, well, I just moved to Peachtree City from the island of Maui, so I'm still in acceptance about culture shock and climate shock. Yeah. Oh, well, acceptance for me really hit home when I heard at a meeting, acceptance is giving up all hope of ever having a better childhood. And that worked for me because I grew up with two professional parents that were both alcoholics. So I've had the family disease. I started drinking prenatally. So did my twin sister. And so acceptance for me is giving up all hope of ever having a better childhood. And that led me to letting go of the resentments that I harbored towards my parents. Thank you.
My name is Tony Webb, and I'm an alcoholic.
Tony.
My original sobriety date was November of 1975, and I came in strictly because of alcoholism. I had not used any other drugs abusively, nothing illegal, prescription drugs that I had not abused. And that all went along well until the year 2000. And in the year 2000, I got into trouble with prescription drugs. And I abused those prescription drugs, but I didn't consider, and my sponsor didn't consider, that I had relapsed because I never drank as a result of that. Let me throw this part of it in. I have a son, my oldest son, who in 1982 came into the program because of alcoholism. And then about in the year 2005, maybe a little bit earlier, he got into problems with prescription drugs, which led to illegal drugs like crystal meth. And we were planning an intervention for him. And as I really started looking at what was going on, I realized that the same thing was happening to him that it happened to me. And my acceptance was I had to accept that I had actually relapsed myself in the year 2000, although I didn't drink. I relapsed just as surely as he was relapsing before me real time. And that acceptance took 7 years, but it was worth the journey.
Thanks, Tony.
My name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Blairsville group in Blairsville, Georgia, and I'm certainly really glad that I was here today. I always try to make the Al-Anon meetings when I come to one of these functions, and it was a reward again. My acceptance story happened to me when I was sober about 8 years. I remember the date. It was June the 28th, and I was going through a period of my sobriety where I was really struggling and I was angry, really, really, really angry. I didn't know I was angry, but I was angry. And the reason I was angry is my wife had been diagnosed with lung cancer. She survived that, which was a miracle, but at the time I was caught up in that anger and fear. Fear always comes out in me in anger. The way I did that is I tried to drive people away. I wasn't consciously aware of it, but I was just so angry. And I know that if I drove them away, I'd probably pick up a drink because I'd be lonely and angry. And I had a friend named Pat. And Pat had gotten sober about the same time I did. And we were really friends. Pat was probably a better friend to me than I was to him. But anyhow, Pat would not let me be alone. I worked in a family business, and this particular day, hot day, I was out on the backyard of our packing house. We were in the citrus packing business and riding around on a forklift, angry and really pissed off. And he'd get a box and come sit down and watch me. And Then I'd stomp after that and go inside and pick up a broom, just start sweeping or something, and he'd go in there, sit down next to me. He wouldn't let me alone. And I'm grateful for that. It's probably why I'm sober today, is Pat's love for me and willingness to be there when I needed someone to be there and I didn't even know it. But the point was is that Pat finally came up to me and got my attention. He says, did you read the 24-hour book today? I said, no, I didn't have time. He says, well, you really should have read it. I said, oh, yeah. He said, what did it say? And here's what he said. It said on June 28, it says that life is basically and fundamentally a mental attitude, an inner attitude. Probably can't remember what troubled you most a week ago. And it really, really shocked me because he was right. I had forgotten that my wife was dying. Right. And it was an important wake-up call for me. Further on in that day, if you like to look it up sometime, it says that it's a blessing we can't see the future. That's why God only reveals it to us one day at a time. And if that you trust in God of what happens and you're living your life right, that, you know, things will work out for you. That's not a quote, of course, but my brother, who's sober member of AA, sober ahead of me, about 6 or 8 years, was in a step study group. A team of men got together to do the steps, and they developed a little prayer that he shared with me, so I'll share it with you today. Because when I can find myself in these non-accepting spots in my life, and I remember, and I'm uncomfortable, and I say this prayer either to myself or out loud, it really turns my day around. And the prayer is, simple as it is, God, thank you for blessing me with absolute, unconditional trust in your will for me today. Amen. And every time I say that or think that, I really get down to the reality of my life, because that's really what it's all about. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Britt Shanks, and I'm an alcoholic, but it's always good to sit in an Al-Anon meeting, and I try to do that often. My acceptance story, I'm a member of the same club, Dick, and hopefully Tony will be here shortly, cancer survivor. And, you know, throughout my sobriety, I learned to be accepting, but the day that I was told that my time was very short, it was unbelievable. It was a full range of emotion. And for the next 3 days, I walked around really angry. But I didn't know it wasn't my fault I was sick, and it wasn't my family's fault or my friend's fault. And it wasn't God's fault that I was sick. But who do I blame? I want to put the blame somewhere. And a friend of mine in the program said to me, you know, enough already. You're walking around, PO'd at the world, quit. It's not you. And it was like somebody had smacked me in the face. I didn't realize I was walking around so angry. When that comment was made to me, and I thought about it for a little bit, I did what this program had taught me to do, and I prayed about it. And when I prayed about it and I said amen and I was done, it was like something had washed over me. It was God's grace. And in that moment, it let me look at the 14 and a half years that I had had sober, of the wonderful life that I had had. Wow. It was like, okay, God, if you're ready to take me now, I have had an amazing life in sobriety. And I am grateful. Just take care of my children, and I'll be okay. And I got busy. Now, the time was really, really short that they gave me. And so I got busy. And even though my oncologist and my other doctors were like, you can't be around people. You know, there's the germ factor, and you have no immune system, and you're so sick. And from the chemo that they were trying to buy me a little time with, to get my affairs in order. But I was busy. I was still going to my home group, even though I showed up in lounge around pants and my slippers and a baseball cap because I had no hair. I was going. This program has taught me to be active no matter what. And so I did, you know. And I accepted what was coming at me as it came at me. And 9 months later, on June the 17th of 2004, my oncologist, who was this mean, short, little, tiny woman, shorter than me. I didn't think that was possible. She walked in and out of my exam room 3 or 4 times. And I said, just tell me what it is you need to tell me. I'm ready and I'm prepared. And this program and everything everybody had taught me and the prayers that had been said, I was okay. I was okay. And I was accepting of whatever my outcome was. And she looked at me and she said, I don't know how to tell you this, but they can't find one single cancer cell in your body. Whew. That was the reaction. I went out and I made my follow-up appointment and I got in my car and I laid my head down on the steering wheel and put the key, you know how you stick your keys in the ignition? Just enough to turn the radio on. And it would be the first time, the CD wasn't even out in stores yet. It was a song by Tim McGraw called Live Like You Were Dying. And I said, okay, God, okay. From here on in, make me of maximum service to you and to my fellow man, which was what this program has taught me. And that's what I've been doing ever since that day. I mean, I laid there and I just cried. Do I have an attitude of gratitude today? You bet. Am I more accepting? Even when, you know, the little things come along, and believe me, everything that happens in my life today that's kind of difficult compared to that situation is small. It's small stuff. But God always seems to give me something to remind me just how fortunate and blessed I am to be where I am today, spiritually, financially, emotionally, physically. And I'm grateful for that. You know, I am truly grateful. And that's my acceptance story. Thanks.
Thank you so much. You know, we all come into on this earth. I think we're either the glass is half full kind of person or the glass is half empty. And I was definitely one of those people that the glass was half full. Half empty, sorry. I'm a little dyslexic, too, so I can never remember which it is. Oh, wow. That's why I can't tell jokes. Anyway, I was always one of those people. You know, I didn't have enough. I always came from that place of want, or at least in the place in my brain that I created. And I have a wonderful friend. Her name is Ellen, and she's from Texas. And in the last couple of years, we've been talking more and more, and we've come to the conclusion that we just don't have big enough glasses. And I want to live my life that way, too. Thanks.
I want to leave you with a prayer that my sponsor shared with me and has been a prayer I prayed for a very long time. It's very short. God, help me want what I have. Can accept, if we can accept what God has given us one day at a time, what a wonderful life we can live. I thank all of you for being here.